Welcome, everyone, to Teaching Peace in Schools, Cultivating Restorative Schools and Communities from the Ground Up. We couldn't be more excited to have all of you joining us today. And, of course, I'm coming at you from Blizzardy, Colorado, so such a warm welcome. And we believe that this topic today and on Wednesday that we are covering couldn't be more important. Imagine what our world would look like if entire generations learned the essential social, emotional, and relational building blocks of peace and conflict resolution. Imagine what it would look like as our kids moved into adulthood with these skills and values and began taking over leadership around the world in all sectors of society. Most importantly, imagine what their lives and our planet would look like, both now and for generations to come. It could transform our world. While we hear far too often how emotionally challenging it can be for kids in our outdated school system, there is simultaneously so much encouraging work already being done in schools around the world, and it's showing great effect. However, it is not anywhere near the scale it needs to be. That is where we all come in. And it's the real driving vision behind this summit and our upcoming course, which we'll share with you a little bit more about later. We indeed hope that this can be a real next level kickoff to a broader national and global conversation and movement on how we can teach and practice these skills, so peace and peace building become the norm in our schools and our greater communities. Today, we are going to hear from some truly extraordinary guides and catalysts who worked in some of the most challenging environments, ones faced with racism, oppression, and poverty, violence, and severe distress. Oakland and Rio de Janeiro, two places in our world where privilege and poverty are literally neighboring each other in every way. And yet, through a lens of equanimity, and of the importance of allowing for meaning and a deeper form of listening, both our guides have helped catalyze communities that are working together with schools and rippling outwards to point our youth and adults alike back to their own value and their own voices, and to address some of the greatest obstacles in our world by doing what may seem almost too simple. This session today is going to take a look at how communities and schools begin to transform the obstacles they face one dialogue at a time. Whether you are a teacher, administrator, parent, human being at large, or someone who is concerned for the future of our youth and our systems, we hope you'll stay with us for the next 90 minutes to hear why restorative practices are changing the way we see and offer education and form our communities, and how they support a deeper look at the essentials that any system is built upon. I'm Molly Rowan Leach, and it's my honor and my pleasure to be your host and facilitator today. And I also serve as the Restorative Justice Fellow for the Peace Alliance, and I'm host and executive producer of Restorative Justice on the Rise. The Peace Alliance and the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice are pleased to co-host this summit and ensuing course. Given that the intention of this space together is for you to participate, we hope that you will, and we encourage you to participate in this conversation by submitting questions via our webcast link, which you should have received in the confirmation email before you hopped on the call here today. And then later on in our session, we'll be opening up the lines for comments and questions. We also want to thank, with sincere gratitude, in the spirit of collaboration, all the many wonderful event partners who helped share the word and who themselves are key collaborators in building a peaceful world. And it's important to us that if you haven't discovered some of these organizations, that you might follow the links by clicking on them via our website and confirmation emails, or by going directly to peacealliance.org. As mentioned, in a few minutes, into the call. We're going to be taking questions, so if you have one, please send them in real time via our web tool that you got in the email that I just mentioned before the call. That's at peacealliance.org/teach-peace-summit. Or you can tweet your questions to #TeachPeaceSummit. That's #TeachPeaceSummit. And we will monitor those and pick some questions out for today's live session. If you're dialed in, we will call on you. So make sure that if you'd like to be called on and not have us read it for you, that you press *2, which raises your hand, so that then you can give voice, your own voice, to the question. And finally, you'll hear more at the close of today's session about our upcoming course. And to find out more about it, we'll remind you this link. Go to peacealliance.org/teach-peace-course. And so without further ado, we'd like to start out today by honoring a very special being who recently passed away, Beverly Tidal. And in order to honor her fully, I'd like to welcome onto this call Jessica Dancing Heart, who is a restorative practitioner, communications coach, and she's the founder of an extraordinary restorative network community. That's Restorative Networks Colorado, and you can find it on the web by Googling Restorative Networks Colorado. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you, Molly. Oh, wow, what a vision to hold, a world of peace, starting with our younger generations, because that's really where our hope lies. And I am feeling so honored that you've asked me to pay tribute to our dear Beverly Tidal, who in her last years chose the name Bebe as her wisdom name. Beverly Tidal is one of those people that has had huge impact on the restorative narrative that we have. And I think one of her biggest contributions by far is the recognizing that everybody matters, every action ripples, and everybody has a gift, and it's our responsibility to help others bring their gift to the world while we do the same. One of the things that I think that is so important about Beverly's work is that she gave us a framework for understanding what restorative practices are, and that is the framework of the 5 R's, which are relationship, respect, responsibility, repair, and reintegration. Those are such fundamentally important pieces of the foundation of restorative practices. The other thing that she did for us was to teach us that restorative practices follow the gamut from connection circles to restorative justice. And that's so important for us because we need to know how to be relational. That is the biggest differentiating aspect of our species, that we are relational beings. And we need to honor that biological distinction that we have. One other gift that she offered was an assets-based approach to the restorative justice circle. I think it's pretty unique. And it's fortunate that in her book, Teaching Peace, she covers that at length. She came from a background of working with at-risk youth, founding Clearview High School in Longmont, which is now Old Columbine High School, where she worked with these at-risk youth and really helped them know that they're valued, they're not throwaway kids, and that we need them. And they're big contributing members of society today. And the assets-based approach she uses are to make sure that we connect to the humanity of people that we would otherwise see as other and not want to connect with. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to give tribute to a really strong peace warrior, Beverly Tidal.
Thank you so much, Jessica. And thank you to Beverly Tidal, wherever she is on her journey now, an extraordinary human being. Her work continues on at Resolutionaries, Inc., and I would strongly encourage those of you who are interested in learning more about the work of Beverly Tidal and her colleagues who continue on, including her daughter, Summer Deaton, go to resolutionariesinc.net. I believe it's N-E-T. So moving into our share sections today with some of our guides, first and foremost, I'd love to just honor both Dominic Barter and Kamisha Fatima Gentry, both here today to share their wisdom and their experiences. And so just up top, giving mention that we're going to be hearing from both of them, and I'd like to share a few words about Dominic and a sentiment or two. And then he's going to do his sharing, and then we'll go into our time with Kamisha. Dominic Barter plays with dialogue and partnership, focusing primarily in the fields of education, justice, culture, and social change. In the mid-90s, he collaborated in the development of restorative circles, Círculos Restaurativos, I believe, a community-based and owned practice for dynamic engagement with conflict that grew from conversations with residents in gang-controlled shantytown favelas in Rio de Janeiro. He adopted the practice for the Brazilian Ministry of Justice's award-winning national projects in restorative justice and supports its application in a further 25 countries. In recent years, he has supervised the mediation program for the police pacification units in Rio, served as invited professor at the Standing Group for Consensual Methods of Conflict Resolution at the High Court of Rio, with a focus on school mediation and bullying, and focused on the development of restorative community. Currently, Dominic directs the Dialogue Restoration Project for the State Education Department of Rio de Janeiro, and partners with the Center for the Study of Public Security and Citizenship at Candido Mendes University. Above all, Dominic is an authentic presence of extraordinary listening and wisdom, and it's just an honor to have him patching in from the UK for what is evening time there, I believe late evening. Dominic, thank you for coming. And just would love it if you might start out by sharing a little bit about both how restorative circles, Círculos Restaurativos, begun, because there might be a lot of people here with us today that may not know a bit about the story, and then go into some of your recent work, please. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Molly. And I'm so grateful for all the work you've done in setting this up, and Peace Alliance and ACRJ as well. It's wonderful to be here, and hello to everybody who's listening in. So as Molly said, I'd like to share a little bit about where this work came from, and then give you a sense of how it's being implied, particularly in the area of education, and then maybe end up with a few clues of areas that I found it's really beneficial for us to look at if we want to create what I call restorative systems, that is, community agreements, organizational agreements that will sustain practices based on dialogue, particularly when the conditions are adverse to dialogue, because those conditions are based on unequal distributions of power. And whenever power is distributed unequally, dialogue has a really hard time being able to feed us in the way that it wants to. So right from the beginning, my work has been very closely connected to young people and closely connected to the ways in which they're seeking to realize their visions for how they can contribute in the world and how they can be part of society. And so that means that in some way, right from the very beginning, my sense of what a restorative practice can look like has been connected to education. And sometimes when I'm going into these places where I don't have much of a sense of exactly what it is that I'll discover, I find that remembering the original meanings of words can be really, really helpful. So on this journey, I became really curious about the original meaning of the word school, because that's one of those words that we use so often that, at least speaking personally, I often would simply forget to question what that actually means. So was interested to find out that the original meaning of the word school comes to us in English from the Greek, describes a place where the rules are suspended and where no laws are imposed. I hope many of you are sitting down as you listen to this, because otherwise you might fall over if you've seen the kinds of schools that I've seen. They're really not very much like that. They're not spaces where rules are not imposed. They're not places in which conclusions are suspended so that we can investigate and question. But specifically in relation to restorative work, this gives us a really interesting challenge. How are we going to respond effectively to conflict without imposing rules? And that for me is one way to begin to understand restorative circles, because what this work has discovered in practice is that if you don't impose rules, then the most effective way to respond to conflict is through dialogue. And not dialogue just as a synonym for conversation, not just as another word for talking, but dialogue as a specific practice of balancing truth-saying and listening, and not moving forward until the truth of someone's speech has been not just heard in terms of its linguistic information by the other people, but only moving forwards when that truth has actually changed the way I see you, changed the way the person listening sees the person speaking. So the beginning of my journey into these big questions and these very practical responses to our daily challenges, particularly in education, was when I moved to Rio about 23 years ago now. And I did that because I was in love. And the person I'd met went home to Brazil. I spent another 6 months in Europe pining for her, and then eventually decided to go too. So I turned up in Rio and saw this extraordinary city, which in many ways is just like the images that people who are not from Brazil have of Rio. The sky is that blue, and the music and the culture and the food and the people are that extraordinary and rich and diverse. The nature is extraordinary, exuberant, and everything about it just fascinated me. And yet at the same time, there was this extraordinary social division, one of the most unequal countries and one of the most unequal cities in the world, and this very, very intense social conflict, which translates not just into horrific statistics about how many people are dying, but a generalized sense of trauma from living in a war zone. And this systemic violence is not just random. It's very clearly organized in ways that make sure that the poor are those who are on the receiving end of most of the bullets, and young people within the poor are disproportionately targeted. And then within that, it's young black males, once again, that are being disproportionately targeted for the violence, both of the state and within communities. And I found it really hard to live in a city with all this beauty and all this killing and danger and separation happening at the same time. And as much as I wanted to stay, it just became overwhelming. I lasted about 6 months, and then I came back. But I found it really hard to be away, knowing now what I knew. So as soon as I had the opportunity to go back, I did. And this time I went back with the idea that I was going to be able to do something about it. And after listening to people and being told time and time again that it was much too dangerous to do anything, much too dangerous to respond, I had a strange idea. And that was that possibly what was making the conflict so violent and so dangerous wasn't simply that people had different ideas about how to take care of their well-being and their security, but that fundamentally people weren't listening to each other when those ideas were expressed. And I thought, well, the only way I'm going to find out if this possibility is related in some way to this sense of danger is by getting close enough to the people who are trying to communicate what they want in order to be able to hear properly. And to do that, I've got to do the very opposite from what my intuition is suggesting I do and what everybody around me is telling me that I need to do, which is rather than getting away from the places that seem dangerous, I need to get closer to them. And I hope, as you're listening, that you are not just imagining the shantytowns of Rio, but maybe thinking of the places near where you live. Those places might be in your family, and they might be in your neighborhood, or they might be in the town that you're living in, or they might be through the internet, places, other places in the world, that in some way, perhaps not consciously, but just through habit, you have started to avoid. People you've started not to listen to, or streets you've decided not to drive down, neighborhoods that you've decided not to go into, or particular classes or groups or ethnicities which you've decided in some way, consciously or unconsciously, to communicate with less, to listen to less. So I decided to test my theory that I would walk towards the places that society was telling me I shouldn't walk towards, and engage in dialogue the people that society was telling me not to engage in dialogue. So I did. The first thing I did was to walk out of the place that I was living in with my girlfriend at the time, walk just under half a mile to the nearest favela, the nearest shantytown, and simply start climbing up the hill and seeing who I might meet. And obviously most adults were busy. They were on their way to work or coming back from work, or they were working in the community, had other things to do. There were a few people who worked for the gangs that were the effective government of those communities, and are in most to this day. And they suspected that I was there to buy drugs, which is what most foreigners or most people who are not from the community would be doing if they were there. And when I said I wasn't, they didn't really know what to do with me. And I ended up finding that only children were available to had the time and the interest, the curiosity to have those conversations. So I just sat on the curb and had this chat with this group of 7 or 8 year olds, and just seeing if I could some way create a relationship there. And I noticed in the tiny moments where that was possible, my degree of fear and insecurity definitely diminished. And that was fascinating to me, because what I was doing felt dangerous, but in certain key moments, it actually made me safer. So I kept on going back. I'd go back several times a week and see if those kids were still around. And slowly I'd start to be introduced to older brothers and sisters of theirs. And then the first groups of teenagers who by then were working for the gangs. Gangs in Rio are the largest youth employer. And a lot of young people are in the gangs, not particularly because they want to, but that's the only way to sustain their family, and their families need the supplementary income in order to survive, because they're domestic cleaners or painters or builders, and they just don't receive wages that enable them to sustain their families and put food on the table. So the kids are working from a young age. And slowly over time, I'd start to meet adults and connect more to the community. And as I did that, consistently two things were really clear to me. Every time in our conversations, just hanging out with no particular agenda, every time someone would celebrate something, someone had some good news, if all of us celebrated together, there was a moment of extra connectedness. There was just that sense of social cohesion, even just for a few seconds. The smiles were there, people's eyes were bright, and you had a sense of commonality which didn't wipe out the huge social differences between us all, but meant that those social differences didn't exclusively define our relationships. If we didn't celebrate with each other, that chance was lost. So even though, still to this day, I don't celebrate quite as enthusiastically as most of the folks that I know in Rio, I know how to get excited by someone else's excitement. I know how to enjoy someone else's celebration. But the other moment was much more challenging for me, and that was when someone had a mourning to share. They had some challenge in their life that they wanted hearing about. They had some painful context in which they were living that they wanted company with. And when they would share those, particularly when that was a conflict, I noticed that all my social upbringing suggested that I move away from those people, or that I somehow try to make the pain go away, say something to make it better or change the subject in some way. And that doing that didn't give us that moment of connection and cohesiveness. So I slowly started to question myself, what would it be like to be with someone when they were in conflict, and to follow that trail and see where it led? And basically that's what I do to this day. Restorative Circles is simply a name that I give to my questioning how do I hang out with this person in their painful or violent conflict? And what will happen if I do?
Hmm.
So as I started to listen more and more to what they were doing, I started to notice certain patterns. People began by telling a story, and they really wanted that story to be heard. And if I heard it in the way I was used to, it went a very well-worn trail and really didn't lead to any significant change. So I started to question myself, how could I listen to that more effectively and find out what's really going on? And the more I did that, more information would come up. We started to notice not just what had happened, but the meaning it had for the person we were listening to. And then we started to notice a kind of cast list of characters who were involved in this painful situation. And it soon became clear that really what this person wanted to do was to communicate in some way with this cast list of characters. But very often they really didn't have much confidence that doing that would do any good. In fact, often it seemed to them a dangerous or scary thing to do. So we started to sit down with the cast list of these characters and see what they wanted to do, and they often had exactly the same situation. What had happened had a lot of meaning to them, and that was one of the reasons why it was bothering them so much, almost as if their feelings of discomfort were messages from their body saying, this is significant, this is important, don't forget it, don't ignore it. And then, after having had that meaning heard, there was some message that they wanted to give the other people involved. But again, they often didn't trust it would be possible. And they talk about, you know, how good it would be if only it was possible to sit down, and the reason why it wasn't possible. The other person wouldn't understand. They wouldn't really listen. They wouldn't take it seriously. Or they'd react in a way that would be frightening or dangerous for this person. So they started to work on what it would be like to create the conditions wherein it was safe to say the things that you wanted to the people you wanted to say them to. What would that look like? And again, it came out in a circle form. Now, none of us had actually heard of restorative justice before. We didn't know anything about mediation or any conflict resolution process. So we were just improvising in the dark. But this circle image came back again and again and again. And since most of the community processes that we were involved in all around us, most of the parties, most of the community practices like samba or capoeira or hip-hop or funerals or marriages or parties or even community debates and meetings all seem to happen in a circular format, it made sense that a circle was the best place to gather, to have a conversation and listen to each other. So we started looking at these circular processes and seeing what we could learn from them and seeing if they could give us any clues. And over a number of years, just practicing and practicing and practicing, we noticed that certain things worked well and other things didn't. And we started following our own examples of best practice. And we created some very simple questions and a very simple structure that would help people get together, say the tough or meaningful things that they really wanted to say to each other, and not just say them, but to say them and have a really good chance that they would be heard by other people, heard in a way that would actually transform behavior. So that's how restorative circles grew. We spent about 9 years doing this in the community before schools and justice systems, prison systems, police departments, and local social services from city governments started to get interested, and the first pilot projects began trying to connect all these different institutions with communities and to create a kind of restorative track so that whenever there was painful conflict or violence in any one of these particular places in society, we could organize a restorative response. So recently, that's turned in, as Molly said when she was introducing me, to a focus on how to connect schools and youth courts so that we can look at the rise of painful and violent conflict as soon as it happens, and respond to it in ways that tend to avoid the dynamics of punishment that are what the legal system knows how to do well, simply because those legal systems are completely overwhelmed. And evidence has shown clearly for many years, and almost anybody working in the system already knows this, that they're just not effective ways of creating the listening without which people are quite rightly unwilling to change their behavior. They're sometimes willing to submit to our ideas of how they should behave, But when they do that, we haven't really transformed the violence. We've just hidden it underground, and it goes into other places. It's sometimes expressed domestically in violence and tension, which is hidden from communities or hidden from legal services, but does just as much, if not more, damage than when that tension is in a school corridor or on the street. Or it goes into psychic ill ease and mental ill health for people who are taught that the reason they're aggressive is because they have some kind of pathology, rather than the fact that society is no longer designed around meeting their fundamental needs, and so their bodies are ill at ease and crying for help, crying for change. And of course, when that happens, it consistently blights, damages, and creates greater pain for those who are already the most marginalized in society, whoever those people are.
Mm.
And the other thing we've done is spend a lot of time with state education departments, seeing if we can create what we call restorative systems in schools. And we like to think in terms of restorative systems because we notice that when we just take a restorative practice off the shelf and bring it to a particular institution, if we're not careful, sometimes it turns into a way of facilitating a continuity of whatever is currently happening. So sometimes it ends up in facilitating the very sense of inequality that we're hoping to transform. So rather than that, what we like to do is set up community agreements or institutional agreements in schools and other learning communities and encourage people to develop their own dialogue processes, their own ways of responding to painful conflict, ways that are meaningful to them, sometimes unique to their communities, and making sure that those practices are owned by the people who use them. So the restorative system within a school, for example, or within a family or within a neighborhood, is really a parallel social process. It's not there to facilitate the same rules that always work, make sure that they happen in a more collaborative form, but end up producing the same results of obedience to the rules that were made not by the community, but by others. And instead, these systems facilitate people in responding to their own issues and creating their own solutions. We enjoy the results better when we do things that way. So for the last 2.5 years now, we've been working with the state education department in Rio to bring restorative systems to all the high schools in Rio State. That's a lot. That's 1,350 high schools. So some of these challenges are really large, but it's a fascinating moment in which institutions are beginning to recognize the importance of doing this work and are starting to be willing to take it on board in a really large scale.
Dominic, thank you so much. I know that you have 5 preconditions that I find for myself to be very rich, and every time you share them, they're something that I learn. And I just want to point out too that when you share as a guide during the upcoming course, you're going to be talking about building those systems to promote dialogue and how restorative circles support community responses to conflict. I just want to make mention of that. But could you share with us a bit, before we bring Professor Mark Umbright into the conversation, those 5 preconditions? You've already been kind of leading into them, I can feel.
Yeah.
But could you be specific about them, and
sure,
then we'll talk with Mark a bit.
Yeah, these are 5 areas that over these 20 years of practical experience, we've noticed consistently need to be taken care of in some way in order for our restorative systems to become sustainable. So you can think of them as clues, places, areas of interest to look out for as you're doing whatever you're doing or moving the systems that you currently have in a more restorative direction. I hope they're pretty obvious, and yet I find it really useful to come back to them and use them as a checklist to see how we're doing in our work every now and then. So the first one is that there does need to be a community agreement that we're going to respond to conflict restoratively. So that might mean all kinds of things depending on the unique conditions of each community, the cultural mores of that particular community and its unique social conditions. But on some level, you need that basic agreement that we're going to respond restoratively. And as part of that, a practice. Now, you can either borrow a practice from some of the many practices that have been developed over the last 40 years, different ways of creating a space for dialogue, or you can develop your own, either taking a clue from some of those established restorative practices, or you can start from scratch just by building your own. But that agreement and developing a sense of what it is that you want to do as a practice in that agreement is a key piece. And when that agreement isn't there, we find we pay a price for it later on. So recently we had a case where a young man was arrested for stealing a cell phone from someone who was actually sitting in a bus. The window was open because the bus was hot, and the bus was stopped at a traffic light. He saw his chance, stuck his hand through the window, and grabbed the guy's cell phone. The guy went after him, caught him, took him to the police station. He was arrested, and the judge said, okay, I'm sending you to prison. But the fact is that in that case, the judge doesn't represent the authority figure for him. So we had a really fascinating conversation with him as part of initiating a restorative process. He was really jazzed about the idea of using restorative circle process to respond to what happened. But he needed to check that it was okay for him to do that. And he didn't need to check that with the judge, because the judge isn't the person who has the authority in his community. It's the head of the drug gang. So he needed to escape from prison in order to ask permission from the head of the drug gang to be able to go back into prison, complete his sentence, and therefore have access to the restorative process. So a well-established restorative system, which is what we didn't have at that moment, this is the very first case in a new system, needed to have involved a dialogue already with the people who had authority in his community. And that was a great feedback for us on how we needed to make our system more restorative. So that's the first precondition, an agreement that we're going to respond restoratively and a particular way of doing it that makes sense for that community. The second piece is very obvious logistically, but can have a great deal of meaning. And that is, we need to find a space in the institution or in the community where these restorative dialogue processes are going to happen. And obviously there's some practical pieces to that. It needs to be a place with not too much external noise so that people can hear each other. But it also needs to be a space that really reflects the power-sharing dynamics that underlie the dialogue process we're going to use. And there are all kinds of ways to do that, all kinds of ways to do that in the way that we take care of the space, make it a welcoming environment, but also in the way we welcome people into the space. Some of us unconsciously will, for example, suggest to adolescents where they should sit, but let adults choose where they sit. Or we'll make similar unequal decisions based on people's ethnicity, based on people's social class, based on all kinds of different factors that distinguish human beings. So space speaks a lot about power, and so does the way that we act in spaces. Becoming conscious of the way that we use spaces, build them, and invite people into them can be really significant in terms of creating an environment in which it's safe to speak the truth. And make no mistake, people read every single micro example of how you're treating them and how you're distributing power. So space is a key precondition. The third one is that all circle processes, those one I mentioned earlier, like parties and funerals and weddings and all those circular community practices, they always have a host. There's always someone who welcomes you. There's always someone who represents some key role in that practice. And those people need to be nurtured. They need to be taken care of. So in our restorative practices, there's going to be a host. It's going to be a facilitator or whatever name you use for that person who invites you in and then holds the questions. So that person obviously needs the material conditions to be able to do their job, but they also need inspiration. They need well-being. They need listening to. They often need an empathic support structure to be able to listen to so much pain without falling into the trap of taking sides or of judging people based on what they've done and using that as a way of understanding who they are. Now, we judge people because we care. We care about how they treat each other. That's not the problem in and of itself. But it becomes a problem when we let our judgments of their behavior turn into judgments of who they are. when we do that, we forget that human beings are fantastically changeable. And that's the wonderful thing about restorative processes. They're constantly remembering that everybody can shift, and the behavior that was painful and done yesterday doesn't need to be repeated tomorrow. So ways of identifying, caring for, nurturing, and inspiring our facilitators are a key condition for a well-functioning restorative system. That's the third precondition. The fourth one is we need to make sure that everybody in the community that has decided to use this process knows what it is, how it works, and how to get access to it. So we're often quite good, for instance, in schools when we set up restorative systems in celebrating that we've done that. Maybe there'll be a mural on the wall which will talk about the history of restorative practices and all the wonderful things they can bring to a school community. But sometimes those murals forget to actually tell us what we need to do in order to be able to access the system. So when we build our ways of publicizing what we're doing, great, let's look at Wikipedia, let's go online, let's be inspired by other people's stories. But let's also remember those pieces of paper that are often stuck to the wall next to the door in a classroom that tell you what you should do in case of a fire alarm, or those pieces of paper in front of you when you sit in an airplane that tell you what to do if there's an accident or something dangerous happens while you're flying, because those are super practical. They say, go to this point, do this, walk fast, don't run, all the different things that you need to do. Those are great examples of the information that we need to share with the community so that everybody knows how to use the practice when they find that they're in a painful or violent conflict or when they witness that other people are. And the fifth precondition is really the simplest to set up logistically, but often the first one that we forget. And that is we need to create an easy-to-access way of initiating a restorative process. We need to create something really simple and accessible to everybody so that any time any member of the community can say, I've just identified myself as someone who is just about to blow a fuse, or I've just blown a fuse, and I know that if I don't do something about it, it's going to get worse. Or, this has just happened to me. Someone's just threatened me. Someone's just hurt me in some way. I know that I need to respond to this to create more safety and to find some way to respond to the harm. Or, I'm a community member. I've just seen or overheard that something bad is going to happen or has just happened. And I know that even though it wasn't me that did it and it's not me that took the brunt of it, it's mine. I'm part of a community where some damage is being done or about to be done. So we need to create really easy to access ways of saying, we need to action our response system. We need to get restorative about the situation. Someone needs to start listening. Mm. So those are the five preconditions.
Excuse me, Dominic, in that fifth precondition, for those of us on today that are listening, that are directly within a school community, would you mind sharing one or two examples of how that has possibly worked within a school community? What are the ways that people have found that work for clear communication, and both for staff and for the student body?
Sure. Well, we started off in the schools that we started working in over a decade ago now with really low-tech solutions, partly because that was the nature of most of the communities who we were working in. So sometimes there was just a piece of paper that requested that you put down your name, the time, and some way of finding you. So in a school, that was often just the number of your, the name of your class. So you'd put, you know, Dominic Barta, 215, 3B. And that was enough. A facilitator would check that piece of paper a couple of times a day. And if they saw that you had initiated a process, then they go looking for you. These days, in many schools, as people start to get access to phones, mobile phones, and phones with more capabilities, there are some more high-tech solutions that start to appear. And I think many communities can find their own way of doing that, depending on what is available for the students and for the staff. But the most important thing is that it's really accessible to everybody, and that there's no permission stage. So sometimes we slip into the idea that we're offering restorative practices as a service within a hierarchy that's already established. So we we might say, oh, I'm sending this particular issue to a restorative practice. Or we might say that someone needs to request one and then we will consider it. So what I found is most important in that fifth precondition is that people know that when they write down that name on that piece of paper or they send a text message or whatever it is to a number that you've established, that that's not a request. There's no permission stage. That person is initiating the practice. So we're really taking everybody very seriously as an engaged member of the community responsible for monitoring and taking care of our collective safety.
Thank you. Wonderful. So now I'd just like to say a welcome to Professor Mark Umbright, who is the president of the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice. He's been in the field as a practitioner for almost four decades, and he's also the director of the Restorative Justice and Peacemaking Program at the University of Minnesota. And such a warm welcome to you, Mark. And I'm wondering if you would like to have a short conversation with Dominic now, or if we'd like to go in with Kamisha Fatima, and then you can dialogue back and forth with both of them and with everyone who is here with us. It's up to you.
And thank you, Molly. Thank you, Molly. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound great. Welcome.
Okay, good. Just one quick question, because I want to leave plenty of time for Kamisha. Dom, it's so good to hear your voice again. It's incredible the work you're doing, and I love the way it's developed so organically from the ground up, even before the language of restorative justice was really present. My one question before moving on quickly, to what extent has restorative justice practices or principles been getting into the court system with offenders in the criminal or juvenile justice setting? Are there examples in Brazil where it's working effectively with offenders?
Yep. I'm delighted to get that question now, because we just recently had some really good news on that front. We started working in youth courts 11 years ago, and just in the middle of December, we got a decision from the National Council of Justice in Brazil that from 2016 on, every youth court in Brazil has to create a restorative option. So that's a major victory for us. In one way or another, we've been working on that for 20 years. And just last week, I started to have the first conversations with the judge who coordinates the youth justice program in Rio State about how we're going to get that up and running. I imagine it'll take several years for us to roll that out. But that work has begun now nationwide, and we're really looking forward to the results.
Dom, I'll be calling you after this because I'd really like to catch up on a lot of things. But let's pass on, because I want to hear Kamisha and all what you've got to share.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mark. And we'll be hearing a little bit more from Mark as we close today, and certainly wanting to honor everybody's time, given that we said we'd be on for 90 minutes, and certainly honoring Kamisha Fatima Gentry. Before we go into our sharing with Kamisha, just a quick note that if you're interested, and I bet you are at this point, if you don't already know about Restorative Circles, go to restorativecircles.org. There's a lot of information there about the international network that has been collaboratively implemented over the past 20 years. So, Dominic, thank you so much, and we'll be coming back with you here shortly. So just wanting to share about Kamisha Fatima Gentry, this woman is an incredible force to be reckoned with. She's currently a consultant in restorative practices, and in the recent past, she served as the Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth School Coordinator at West Oakland Middle School in Oakland, California. She was raised in San Francisco's Fillmore District, and then at the time, the heart of the Black community in Northern California. As a teen, she was caught up in the street life, and after conversion to Islam and other experiences which helped her get her life back on track, Kamisha Fatima enrolled in Bennett College, which was the first African-American women's college in the nation's history. where she earned a bachelor's in communications. She traveled to South Africa and Saudi Arabia during this time and broadened her horizons even further, pursuing graduate studies at Mills College and received a master's in educational leadership in 2009. She was a part of facilitating a self-help course for San Quentin inmates with Keeping It Real, a self-development training group, and has also worked as a counselor and facilitator for the Oakland Parks and Recreation Office's Radical Roving Recreation Program, an initiative that focuses on Oakland's most at-risk street youth. And since the fall of 2009, she's been employed by RJOI as a school coordinator assigned to Street Academy, a continuation high school in Oakland. She's responsible for implementing restorative processes at the school site, both in response to conflict and as a means of creating a stronger, healthier, and more caring school community. She demonstrates by example that it is possible for youth to turn their lives around and become effective and powerful forces of positive change in their communities. She was accepted to a doctorate program in 2013, where her focus was depth psychology, concentration in community, liberation, and eco-psychology. No small thing there. Kamisha Fatima has also worked with such groups as ESSE Justice Group, All of Us Are None, IMPACT, which is Incarcerated Men Putting Away Childish Things, WISE, Women Incarcerated Still Enduring, and California Coalition for Women Prisoners, to name a few. And probably most importantly, she is the mother of three girls. Kamisha Fatima, it is just an honor and a pleasure to have you here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Molly. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here as well.
I know you've taken quite the journey yourself in working with youth and within systems, and wondered if you might share with us a bit about your most recent work and some of the challenges, as well as the opportunities and openings that you've seen. And, of course, Kamisha Fatima will be a guide in the upcoming course as well. So there's a lot we can cover today, but in a nutshell, just topping off for us some of the challenges and the opportunities that you've seen.
Yes, of course. And thank you, Molly. Thank you, Peace Alliance and NCRJ, Dominic. It's an honor and a pleasure to be part of this conversation today. I am currently at a middle school, and I had an anonymous piece I'd like to share to set the stage for my few minutes in sharing today, if that's okay. Molly?
Well, yes, absolutely. Please do. And you have hopefully what we are looking at is an equal amount of time of sharing, and then we'll go into dialogue with the questions that have been submitted by those that are present with us today.
Okay. I'm just looking at the time, so I'll
right.
end a little bit sooner so we can make sure we get time for those questions.
Great.
All right. It's really quite simple. Even within the momentum of ego-driven behaviors and systems, barricades built by white supremacy divide us geographically by religions, class, culture, color, so on and so on. Restorative justice is a practice that cracks open the door. For when we walk through while having difficult conversations with breaks of uncomfortable moments of silence, mindfulness, meditation, bringing us back to ourselves, there is a growing green space with fertile soil for us to recognize our emotions, thoughts, grounding us in a place of confidence, faith, and oneness. And don't forget to dance, laugh, play, move, reunite with nature, and watch animals and how they mate and interrelate. Be in sync with the universe, for it is a waste to hate. Building relationships, taking responsibility for our actions before being confronted with confrontational interactions. So there is no need to be defensive, for we indeed do have everything we need to get to where we want to be. also, I like getting right to the core. Dominic set a wonderful foundation for me to pick up from some of the challenges in implementing restorative justice in our schools, not to mention our staff turnover rate. For folks that are not familiar with Oakland, West Oakland, and our environment, it's a microcosm of many cities throughout our nation and the world. We are an inner-city urban community with issues such as gentrification. We have violence, abuses of all forms. It's really an honor and some serious challenging work to be in such a community with such a heightened level of humanity living in such desperate measures. And as we see gentrification continuing to unfold at this phenomenal rate, and our communities are becoming more vibrant and lively and colorful, and buildings are being built and streets and holes are being filled in and corrected from the cracks, the color of the people of the community are disappearing. And we have other folks coming in, white people from other areas, and people of color are moving further and further and further out of the Bay Area. Our students and teachers obviously suffer from this type of community, and the resilience that we see occur day in and day out, and I'm smiling right now because I'm thinking about my school. I'm thinking about our school as I speak in this moment and what they're going to say tomorrow when I return. And some of the teachers listening to this conversation. So it's very important that I keep it very much real, and I'm hoping that people, as Dominic said when he was speaking, that you're not just thinking about my words in the community I'm speaking of, but relating it to where you are in your community. Recently, there were a number of conflicts that were happening because of the Muslim community that has increased immensely this past year at our middle school between the African-American students and the Muslim students, primarily from the Middle East and the Yemen area. I'm going to use this as an example of what we do at West Oakland Middle School to try to implement restorative justice practices. So we've divided and prepping for this culminating series of circles with both groups, but we needed to divide first by gender and by ethnicity to have these very hard conversations where students accepted responsibility for some of the things that they said and that they did to their class counterparts. And then we did the Yemeni students first, and then we had held circle with the African-American students, and we're currently getting ready to bring those two groups together. And it's really been an example of what needs to happen worldwide, not only in implementing RJ in our schools, but in our systems, in the juvenile system that was brought up earlier. As we need a focused individual conversations with groups first, is my opinion, for us to process and to get out the things that are hard to say sometimes when you have other ethnicities, when students don't feel comfortable talking. In the Islamic world, a lot of times the women are not comfortable talking with the young men in the room. Students and adults not feeling all the way comfortable sharing what they're really going through, what they're really dealing with. while the other part is in the room, the other counterpart is in the room. So once we do that and build these relationships, keeping the movement, my new thing that I'm focusing on and theme is to incorporate lots of movement when we're in circle process. When we're dealing with this level of trauma and violence on a daily basis, to sit in circle for even 15 minutes with, we know, our students, some of the ADD issues that a lot of our students have, and being born drug addicted as well, we have to keep the movement going. So being able to incorporate, for example, a building relationship game where you ask for hard questions, you have them put on a piece of paper on different four corners of a piece of paper. Who do you trust? What do you love? What do you hate? And to begin conversation, ball up those pieces of papers and have a paper fight for a very short amount of time. Especially with middle schools, before it gets out of hand, they're able to have fun. They're able to interact. And then sit down and have everyone read one of those pieces of paper to start the conversation. We're honored to be in collaboration with Bay Peace, who headed that workshop for us. They are working with us with our RJ peer leadership group now, that meets once a week, and they come in twice a month to help raise our awareness on events, as well as get in touch with ourselves and being able to deal with ourselves and others in a more peaceful way. Going back to some of the challenges in implementation of restorative justice, we have a lot of new teachers and old teachers coming in, old elder teachers that have been in the district for many, many years, as is throughout our country. And there's been many practices that have been introduced, and it seems that every year, few years, there's a new, they call it the flavor of the month. And right now, RJ happens to be the flavor of the decade. And so that has its wear and tear on teachers that have honored us with their time and energy for 10, 20, 30 years. And so then we have the newer teachers that are oftentimes young. They haven't started their families yet. They're straight out of school. Some have not finished school yet, and their perspective is quite different. Their systems are changing now, so that their courses that they're getting, that teachers that have been in the district did not receive, and preparation for classroom and curriculum and blackboard configurations in our we're a STEM school at West Oakland Middle, and so we have some of those technologies available to us. And so integrating our new way of life into our middle school and with the age, the violence, the race, there, after we all break up into our respective groups and with the relationships that we're comfortable in and have these difficult conversations, coming together and merging those groups is a very sensitive process. And to bring ourselves, our whole selves to that process, for folks that are used to doing things for a long time versus folks that are very more flexible and able to incorporate or more easily incorporate new ways, that brings on, you know, the obvious challenges. So, the triggers that can occur while we're in those processes, in conversations, in the hallways, some of the successes, some of the improvements I've seen over the years in our middle school, when you're working with students, asking them how they're doing, if they had breakfast, what's going on. Generally, when students are misbehaving, it has nothing to do with you. They're not disrespecting the person that they're in conflict with. It has something to do, as we know, with something totally different. And the behavior is just this offspring of the core issue that's really going on, which oftentimes teachers and staff, and myself included, go unnoticed. We don't even approach or respond to that in the middle of a day during lunchtime, when everyone is in middle school age group, wanting to touch on each other. We have a rule that we don't horseplay at the school. Well, to have students not touching all day long, it's a big task. But the reason for most of our fights begin by this playful acting and kids being kids, and then it gets serious. And you mix that with the trauma, generational trauma, community trauma, ongoing, not post-traumatic slave syndrome or stress syndrome, but prolonged traumatic. Yes, syndrome. It makes for a very touchy environment. But and some of the amazing transformation moments that I've had the honor to witness are adults and students alike checking themselves, resetting themselves. And people think that RJ takes so long, and yes, full processes of big issues do take time. It starts from small bits of time that can be done during transition. I have new duties this year, and once I got over my ego about some of my duty changes, I was able to say, wow, there's a lot of RJ work that can happen during transition, during lunchtime duty of supervision, and checking in with students and having them, with students that I have worked with for a couple of years now, how do you right your wrong with this situation? What do you take responsibility for? What's wrong with this conversation right now? Are you talking to me, or are you talking to everybody, when we have a kind of loud mouth and showboating going on? And immediately, in most cases, students are resetting themselves. They're checking themselves, and you see this adult, this more mature human being arise right before your eyes. And those small moments, in turn, lead to them being in these very difficult conversations in bigger circles and in family group conferences. As we integrate and are increasing our integration of community members, we have people, and everyone throughout this country and this world, there are community members that are not being used, that we need used, I mean, in the most, you know, honored way, that have relationships built with adults, with the teachers, with administration, with the students primarily, that have the ability to come into the school. It doesn't have to be all day. It doesn't have to be half a day. But just to have that ebb and flow of community members, so that the students see that we're all together in this. And so, and you see a different side of a student show up, you know, when that community member who maybe runs the recreational park nearby, or even the community member that may be the neighborhood person that hangs out on the street. A lot of people don't recognize they may be doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They also have a job, and they also have a built relationship with the student that we need.
And that's how you bring in the community in certain ways, to strengthen the relationship and strengthen that space for which a circle process perhaps is set up in a way that might open some doors, correct?
Correct.
Kamisha Fatima,
yes.
There's probably a lot of people with us today that may not know, when you say we did it, you know, what exactly, could you frame for us exactly what are you embarking upon? What's like a typical process for you? How does that feel? Are there pre-circle processes that you do? Would you mind giving us a little bit of a picture of that, so that we have that to take with us today?
Well,
how is it working for you?
Yeah, I apologize if I did say, I did say we did it. What I try to say is we
That's
are doing
okay.
it.
Right,
we
no,
are
that's
doing
fine.
It.
Just give us a little, paint us a picture, if you would, please.
Yes. Similarly to what I explained before with the cultural and religious series of circles, I spoke to each one of these students beforehand, before even bringing them with their prospective group. We had check-ins. I asked them what their reservations were. Are they willing to be part of this process? And then once we all got together, there were some conversation with most of the parents, not all of the parents. To do it again, I would have made sure I covered all of the parents. But most of the parents, there were some discussion about how we were going to approach. Depending on where the referral comes from, whether it's administration, teacher, or something that I see in terms of preparing for a circle, generally, you know, you do your prep and your one-on-one with all parties involved separately. And then if it's a bigger circle, you want to include another circle keeper for one person to hold. You know, so much going on I don't find is a healthy process. It's better to have a close circle keeper. And then in bringing people together, having them have a role. So a student doing the opening, another student doing the closing, someone else leading, one of the relationship building games, asking them what they want to get out of the circle, and letting the community be the guide, and the circle keepers just being the convener. And then, of course, the follow-up. The follow-up is crucial, to follow up individually and as a group on how do they think the circle went, how could it have been better, what can we do for this process to grow within our school community. We've had so much turnover in the last 4 years, and our students come in and out of our school all the way up until June. So to try to hold a community and make a process sustainable is quite the challenge, as I said earlier. I hope that answered. Can you ask, if I did not answer your question in full, can you?
No, that's great. I just think it's so helpful for those of us who may want to approach understanding more how to do something like this in our own community, in our schools, in our families, wherever that may be, just to have a sense of its, you know, what does it entail practically.
Right.
One other thing, very curious about it, and I'm sure folks gathered here together are as well. Today in our education system in the United States especially, I can't speak for other places in our world, but I know this is an international call today, teachers are overloaded. You've mentioned about staff. Dominic has referred to circumstances where there's just this sense of overload, of it being just too big of something to take on. What are a couple of things that you hold with you when you approach that, both in working as yourself as a staff member in a school, but also with teachers and educators? What are you finding around answering to that, you know, very real feeling that there's just already too much, and how would we ever take this on?
Yes. Well, first is the third of the five conditions Dominic presented earlier, caring and nurturing. The self-care is a priority. It's a priority to value self-care and hold self-care in a way that we've never held self-care before, speaking from this community, speaking from our system. And you're weak if you cry. When I'm talking about crying, I'm talking about not just crying for sadness, but crying in awe, crying in release and cleansing and healing. You're weak if you're not working hard if you take a break, if you take a lunch. You're not a hard worker. You're not serious about your work if part of your self-care is getting massages, going to support groups, just really honoring yourself and quiet time, moments of quiet time, even amongst others. We're in this momentum where we feel like we have to fix it, solve it, and talk constantly. And I was just in a retreat where I was quiet for the longest period of time in that type of setting with about 100 people. And I, for over 4 days, and I'd never been this quiet ever in my life in that setting. And the wisdom that came to me and the growth that I was able to receive and allow in because I wasn't talking was just unbelievable. So the self-care piece. The keeping up, of course, the reading, I know, keeping up with research. So reading and is another duty and another time-consuming thing for folks who are feeling like they're just doing too much reading and doing too much research. They have YouTube videos. We have videos of processes and keeping up with the new trends of technology and celebration and honoring each other and spending more time on lifting each other up through celebrations and reintegrating a lot of our indigenous practices of culture and dance and way to hold each other up and acknowledging each other for, you know, our small challenges and our day-to-day difficulties, as well as monthly and yearly, not just birthdays and these holidays that most of our holidays, people don't even know the history of. We won't get into that. That's a whole nother telesummit.
Right.
But understanding what we're celebrating and honoring those who have passed. I like to flip it and ask people, what gives you power? Where do you get your power? You know, and a lot of our students and a lot of adults, for that matter, you know, it's a long silence, it's a long pause, and it's a scramble if you're not in this work to figure that out and to hold that value of self-care and a priority. So that would be my number one thing I would say to answer that.
Thank you. Just from the heart, Kamisha Fatima Gentry. And just to mention that Kamisha Fatima will be guiding a course session in March. This is a 9-week course that we're about to embark upon. And, of course, Dominic as well will be one of our guides with one weekly session per week starting February 10th. We'll open our series with Kay Prannis and Carolyn Boyce Watson, whose work has spread deeply and far in the Chicago, Boston, and New York, as well as Los Angeles public school systems. A little bit more about that in a moment. Let's go back now to what we promised, in including those of you that are here with us today, your questions. A lot of questions have come in. And I'd like to open up the mic of both Kamisha Fatima and Dominic so that you may choose if you'd like to respond to this first question, either or. The way we'll do that is just go ahead and if it resonates, step right in. The first question from our participant circle today is from Ronald in Tampa, Florida. Thank you, Ronald. And he asks, I think a very important question that we've touched on quite a bit today, but let's reiterate it. How do you begin the process of building a restorative justice system? Who needs to be involved? And what are some best practices for getting buy-in from staff and students?
I liked one of the things that I heard you say, Kamisha Fatima, just now, which was about honoring the people who've gone before and laid the groundwork for anything like this starting. And I think that's one clue to responding to this is looking into a particular community and seeing, well, who have the people who've actually been holding this flame all along? Because a restorative system is not a new idea that we bring from somewhere else. It's something that's already present. There's always people who are trying to listen, who are trying to dialogue, who are remembering the humanity of everybody, even when things get tough and painful. So connecting to those people, honoring those people, and listening to them so that we can find out what they know about what works and what doesn't work and how things could be if we finally started putting into place the dreams and the practices they have. That's one of the most effective ways that I've found of starting.
Thank you, Dominic. Yeah. And Kamisha, would you like to?
Yeah, sure.
Kamisha Fatima.
One of the reasons why we went from two full-time restorative justice coordinators in 2009, there were other people, of course, practicing restorative justice, the modern term and derivatives thereof, to now today having over 40 school coordinators through the district. David Usum is our program manager, a department now in our district. Nancy Nadell was a premier person, a pivotal person in the conception of our joy and restorative justice for Oakland youth, coming from attitudinal healing, and an elder, Sister Aisha. Judge Gail Barriola from our juvenile, who was at the time chief juvenile justice judge from our juvenile system. So we really had community, as they say, from the top down and the down and the bottom up, that helped a buy-in process over the past few years get to where we are today with RJ. Now, of course, there's difference of opinion of how long does it take to fully integrate and implement restorative justice in our school systems. And it depends on how much that buy-in and how you get that buy-in. We do need to make home visits, you know. We do need to have gatherings where we have already in events that we have, Black History Month, the holidays that we're celebrating, those that I mentioned earlier that we don't know the history of, having some portion of those events at school in circle where we're just simply doing an opening and a closing, having staff meetings, opening and closing, our cost and our counseling services and extracurricular. YMCA provides our after-school programming. They've also incorporated some of restorative practices into their programming. And so really having an all community, even if it's just pieces here and there,
mm-hmm.
and community citywide. Heather Manchester has done a phenomenal job with the mayor's office doing circles and organizing our youth throughout the district. Our current mayor did in her first 100 days of office, met with 100 students throughout our district. So to have someone in each of these branches really does help. And if we could get the recreational and church religious groups and community, as I said before, organizations on board and collaboration, doing their stuff as well, doing the things that they do as well, not just saying, come and try this new thing like I did when I first started at Street Academy years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was so excited, and that's not the approach. We want to be all inclusive.
So there's somebody that said once, this work is too urgent to rush.
Yeah.
And actually that is from Dominic, I believe. And I think that really sums it up, that this work is too urgent to rush, and it's something that is an inquiry process, I believe, of listening to needs and understanding what those might be, as opposed to proselytizing or saying, well, this, you know, we've got this and we think you should use it. Let's go to the next question, given that we want to be respectful of everyone's time today. We still have some words from the NACRJ, as well as the Peace Alliance, and then some information about this upcoming course, which is not only going to be a way to really grind some nuggets with Kamisha Fatima and Dominic directly, but also with other people who will be talking about mindfulness in schools, for example. That's Chris McKenna from mindfulness.org, is going to be one of our class teachers and guides, and we'll also be covering social emotional learning as well as nonviolent communication. So I hope you'll stay with us just for a few more minutes today as we answer some of your questions and go into just a little bit more detail Again, somebody shared a quick note that restorative circles, it's restorativecirclesplural.org. So if I said it wrong earlier, make sure you go, if you're interested in finding out more about the work of Dominic Barter and the International Restorative Circles Network, that's restorativecirclesplural.org. John from Athens, thank you for your question. This is a really ripe one as well. How do we work to include staff as participants in a restorative process? It seems that often teachers and administrators have the primary job of maintaining order and control and sometimes are suspicious of being open in a circle. So feel free to respond if you wish, Dom or Kamisha Fatima.
Can you repeat the last sentence of the question?
Sure. John from Athens, again, from Athens, Georgia. It seems that often teachers and administrators have the primary job of maintaining order and control and sometimes are suspicious of being open in a circle.
Yeah.
Great point.
Yeah, it's a wonderful point. And building that confidence in the relationship with the allies of that teacher or of that administrator beforehand and getting a sense of where they see power, asking them series of questions about their power, definition of power, and how the classroom management, if it's a teacher, or how a staff meeting, if it's an administrator, how do they see it going, and where would they like it to move to? The distribution of power is a huge issue when we're dealing with circle, and doing that among adults, of course, at first is a better idea, and building that capacity rather than trying to do that with teachers while they're in circle with their students, having the teacher be involved in the circle and lead and be a part of the circle and holding that circle as a co-circle keeper with the restorative justice coordinator, if possible, and community members is a good way to see how that power is distributed. And there it's empowering to have that power distributed, because then there's less work that that teacher is going to have to do because the community is holding itself accountable.
Mm-hmm. Dominic, would you be willing to share a bit about what you've witnessed in a sense of the shifting, so to speak, mechanism of power from one person holding over and instead of sharing with?
Yeah, I mean, I like all we just heard. I was thinking of the way those two words seem to so easily go together, the words that John used in the question of order and control, and whether really control is the most effective way of bringing about the order that we'd like to see. I think that's an open question, especially when you're in a school context, when you're really wanting to support young people in developing their critical capacity to be able to look at the questions that they're learning and look at society as a whole. We are at this unique moment in history where the kind of challenges we're looking at are challenges that haven't occurred before. So the solutions that we already know are not going to cut it. So we're looking for something new. And I think that gives us a really exciting and fascinating challenge collectively, which is how to create contexts in which people are able to investigate beyond the known. And as teachers and administrators in schools, concerned with everybody's safety, everybody's well-being, concerned with the conditions that make it possible for people to learn, but at the same time, concerned with creating spaces where young people can, in their thinking and their behavior, go beyond the social norms that we're used to and challenge some of the most ingrained injustices that are built into those social norms. It's a lot of work, But as a teacher and someone who spends a lot of time with folks who teach and direct schools, I have seen so many examples of this extraordinary sense of liberation when people actually stop trying to manage other people's behavior, stop seeing conflict as something negative which needs to be resolved or marginalized or shut down, and actually discover this extraordinary sense of well-being and satisfaction and contribution that they get when they're no longer controlling people, but actually creating the conditions for people to work out, well, what kind of school society and what kind of wider society do they want themselves? And when they do that, people don't want to treat each other badly. You know, they want to live in relationships of trust. They want to establish that kind of basic community well-being. In fact, they want to be known for contributing something unique to the well-being of the community.
Exactly.
And it's a beautiful experience for a teacher to realize that they can get some of that that they were hoping for, that original dream that led them into the profession in the first place. And let's face it, it's a really, really tough job. They can get some of that dream back. In fact, when they try and control a little less and find that the order works out itself.
Well said. One more thing, Molly. I know our time
Please.
Is running tight. For the question from Austin, focusing on sameness, whether we're talking about biologically and we all having a heart that pumps red blood through our veins, or we're talking about socially, everyone wanting to belong, love, and be loved, when we're trying to work out issues and egos within ourselves about power and how and distributing power and letting go and letting the community take care of itself in the way that it naturally knows how to do, and beginning reintroduced to that and being reminded of that, I find that those things are also a help, so that we don't get caught up in this perpetuation, the system of reaching outside ourselves in an attempt to feel unsatisfied with empty and the lonely holes of moments of shadows and darkness. And all the meantime, we have everything we need inside ourselves to get where we want to be, and all this reaching outside is this waste of time of just moving in this momentum, and we're just going and going. Where when we stop and practice that mindfulness and go inside, we recognize our confidence and our power within, and so that power and ego becomes less of an issue, and we can focus on what we need to focus on.
Thank you so much, Dominic and Kamisha Fatima, and there have been so many great questions, and of course, as usual, we're running a bit over and need to close, but I just would encourage, before we close today, of course, stick around with us if you can, please. We're going to share a little bit about the course upcoming, the opportunity to take an even deeper dive with both Kamisha Fatima and Dominic and others. Fania Davis will be with us. I mentioned Chris McKenna and mindfulness, and if you're interested in just checking out what's going to be happening starting February 10th, please go to peacealliance.org/teachpeacecourse. We will be offering a credential sheet that you can submit for continuing education credits, just to make note of that before some of you might have to go on. We will offer that as a part of this experience, and we've created a sliding scale of rates for those of you who might have financial challenges in these times. So I'd like to welcome again back to share a bit about the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice, Professor Mark Umbright, who is the president of the NACRJ, again, the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice, NACRJ.org. Mark, can you share with us a bit about the association and, of course, we're co-hosting this together with the Peace Alliance. Welcome
sure.
back.
Thank you. Thank you, Molly. The National Association was set up several years ago to really help support this social movement called restorative justice. When I was first involved in restorative justice more than three decades ago, it was absolutely marginal. Very few expressions of it, no one took it real seriously. Today, it is so exciting to see the way restorative principles and practices are taking shape all over the country, actually all over the world. This is an international social movement. And in settings that are way beyond the juvenile justice system and criminal justice system where it began more than 30 years ago. The National Association is not set up to be a tight professional organization to control or certify things or anything like that. Quite the contrary. It's meant to be help nurture and support the development of this field, to offer support to statewide and regional associations that are coming together to work with each other on restorative practices. We hold national conferences every other year. Our next conference will be in Oakland, California in June of next year. And we're going to be soon implementing a policy of providing some limited mini-grants to help local regions and states develop their programs. We don't have a lot of funding, but we want to do everything we can to support this field. In fact, we have virtually no paid staff. This is all driven by the passion and energy of our leadership team, which is quite broad and representative of all kinds of folks. And our national association is really meant to bring voice to the movement so it can be heard in different policy settings, whether it's state or national, where we can provide technical assistance and help in many, many forms, and to really be in a broad umbrella under which all different expressions of restorative justice can feel comfortable, realizing we don't have to agree on everything. We don't have to all agree this is the absolute pure way to do it, because there are differences and different approaches, and that's good. But our association wants to really help nurture and support movement. And we're so happy to be able to co-sponsor this event today, and there'll be more in the future with the Peace Alliance.
Mm. Thank you, Mark, so much for everything that you are and do. And I'd like to hand over the mic now to the Peace Alliance's president, Mr. Bob Baskin, for a few words about the work that the Peace Alliance is involved in. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Molly, and thank you, everyone who joined us today and spent the time with us, and in particular these two remarkable leaders who really have gotten us started on helping to understand how this kind of approach could be utilized more effectively in our communities. For those of you who do not know about our work, we are the Peace Alliance, really, is a grassroots educational and advocacy organization focused on transforming how individuals, communities, and even nations respond to conflict and violence. We try to do it in a positive way with the prevention and intervention solutions that we promote, which have been proven effective in saving lives and dollars and enhancing cooperation skills and increasing social resilience. We believe that that approach talks more about the solutions than the problems. We champion evidence-based peace-building legislation on the Hill and in states and policies by encouraging policymakers, the media, and the public to support these conflict violence reduction approaches. We've focused specifically on five key peace-building cornerstones, recognizing that we can't do it all. And they are empowering community peace-building, teaching peace in schools, which you've heard a little bit about today, humanizing our justice systems, fostering international peace, and finally, cultivating personal peace within ourselves. We feel confident that with the help of people like you, we can really shift our culture in a positive new direction. And you can learn much more about what those cornerstones and the work we do are at our website, www.peacealliance.org. Again, I just want to thank you all for joining us today. We hope you will seriously consider the upcoming courses. It's a truly incredible faculty lineup where I believe you will learn so much, and we're looking forward to doing it. And I want you to all have a great day, and I hope to see you all on Wednesday. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Bob. And by Wednesday, he means please join us again for part two of our Teaching Peace in Schools summit. That will be featuring a focus on social-emotional learning with Congressman Tim Ryan, who has done extraordinary work with a bill that's actually on the table right now as we speak to that end. He speaks eloquently and powerfully to the importance of practical solutions within our systems relating to schools around social-emotional learning. We will also be delighted to host Jim and Jory Mansky, who are a part of the Center for Nonviolent Communication and have done work in schools with NBC, that's the acronym for Nonviolent Communication, for many, many years. So please do join us. That's going to be at 5 p.m. Pacific this coming Wednesday, and we'll go for the same amount of time relatively and same format as we did today. Now, just in closing, to reiterate to you, the community that we'll be building over the course of our 10-week, actually, overview course, which starts February 10th, it will feature inspiring wisdom and leadership. You'll also get a chance to bring your own problems that you can work into possible solutions with the course guides themselves. We're going to leave time for breakout sessions and actual tangible practices in many of the courses. You'll have an opportunity to ask and talk about your own situations in your own communities directly with the course guides themselves, including, again, Dominic and Kamisha Fatima. We're also going to be looking, again, at social-emotional learning, how bullying can be reduced and truancy going down, grade point averages possibly rising, and more importantly, self-worth rising to the point where we're looking at a community of people who feel like they can be heard and that it's safe to express what's going on for them. In Colorado, where I'm from, one community that, you know, we started out the hour and a half together today honoring the life of Beverly Title, she started the Longmont Community Justice Partnership, and it was built from the foundations of teaching peace. And she was an integral part in collaborating to create a system that is now showing 8% recidivism in that community of Longmont, Colorado. Of course, she didn't do that alone. She did it with the help of many community members. And perhaps that's how we mean when we say building a restorative school community. So just in closing today, again, inviting you to visit peacealliance.org, teach peace course, pass it along, share it with people in your communities, in your school systems, and also do know that there's an opportunity for you to be in a collaborative partnership as an affiliate if you'd like to share this with your systems and with your lists. You can receive 20% off of the tuition coming back to your organization. So it's just a way of saying thank you and being in the spirit of collaboration and partnership. Finally, once again, please join us this coming Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific. And thank you so much for staying longer than you expected with us today to hear from Dominic, Kamisha Fatima, and to discuss these important, very key underlying measures that we can take and look at in a different light. I have been just thrilled to be with you today here as your host. Again, my name is Molly Rowan Leach, and thank you to the Peace Alliance and to the National Association of Communities and Restorative Justice, and to restorativecircles.org, and to Kamisha Fatima Gentry, and to all the people that are working with our youth in our systems. Have a great afternoon and evening. Thank you again, Dominic and Kamisha Fatima, for being with us today. We'll see you on Wednesday.